My name is Courtney Morris, and I'm an organizer with No Justice Under Capitalism, which is a United Front coalition that came together in April to address the state's criminal negligence in the spread of COVID in prisons, jails, and detention centers. And it's quickly developing to also be addressing the wildfires and ultimately state failure across the board.
Rashid?
Yeah, my name is Rashid Stanley Lockhart. I am a formerly incarcerated individual who has spent the majority of his life incarcerated, impacted by the system since the age of 15. I've been incarcerated every year. I'm now 42. And for the last 2 years, I was working as a lead engineer firefighter while incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison. I now work for a nonprofit organization called Planting Justice, where I'm a reentry coordinator.
So I've been really surprised by the number of people who are unaware of the fact that the incarcerated population have been a major component to controlling California's wildfires. I'm surprised about kind of the lack of awareness around this, but I'm wondering if you could, maybe Rashid, we'll start with you for this, talk about that program and what you think people should know about it and what's at stake with it now.
Well, one of the first things they should know is that us as incarcerated people, we want to be firefighters, right? We want to be fighting these fires that we're fighting, and we're not asking to abolish the system. We're asking for equality and opportunity. The incarcerated firefighting force makes up almost half of the firefighting force in the state of California. And when you hear, you know, recently Cal Fire on TV saying, hey, be patient with us, we don't have the resources, we don't have the manpower, what they aren't saying and what they are saying is that we don't have the incarcerated firefighters anymore, right? Well, they do, but they don't have the number of incarcerated firefighters that they had. And for us as incarcerated people, it's the opportunity to have a sense of purpose, to have camaraderie in a way that's unlike anything we've ever been a part of. And it gives us the opportunity to work outside of ourselves, if you will, right? And have an impact and feel like we are doing our part in giving back to society and the community at large while changing the face of not only who we are, but how the world sees us.
And then, what does it involve to, what does the training program look like to prepare people who are incarcerated to become firefighters? What kind of training do they have? What does it look like when they're working, when they're actively working on duty to assist in fighting fires?
Well, it's the same exact training as a firefighter who's not incarcerated, right? We go through all the same exact, we go through all the same certifications and everything that regular firefighters go through, except that I won't say regular firefighters because we are firefighters, but the firefighters who are not incarcerated, we go through the same trainings except for our EMT certifications. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. That's the one thing we can't get is the EMT certification. Other than that, we go through all the same exact training. Like I myself, being a lead engineer on a Type 1 fire engine and the lead on the ambulance crew, I went through all the basic first responder medical trainings, and I went through all the basic pump operation trainings and driving trainings for emergency vehicles.
And then when you get out, I understand it's not easy to just transition into maintaining your profession as a firefighter. Is that true? There's obstacles that you'll encounter?
It's almost impossible. So what happens is, with felonies on our records, we're barred from going into a lot of like municipal firefighting departments won't have us because they want EMT certified firefighters at their departments, which makes sense. It's not a knock on them as departments. It's state law, though, however, that bars us from getting an EMT license, which in return bars us from getting our or getting into a municipal fire department, which is like a city fire department. And to become a wildland firefighter, you know, once you get out, you now have to go through the certifications all over again, because for whatever reason, the certifications and the same trainings that you went through while incarcerated are no longer any good. So it's almost like this thing of like, I draw the parallel of like slavery, how, you know, slavery is allowed while incarcerated. Well, apparently so is firefighting for the incarcerated people. Cause once you get out, there are a lot more roadblocks in place than there would be for the average person.
So either of you could respond to this. Some might argue then that the state of California has a vested interest in maintaining in the issue of mass incarceration, right? The more people that are being incarcerated, the more firefighters we have. And we're seeing this kind of the system corrode a little bit as we have a COVID pandemic and fewer eligible incarcerated people. What should we be gleaning from this moment?
Well, I mean, it's simple. Incarcerated firefighters save the state of California $100 million a year, right? That's where this is where the issue is, really. At the end of the day, we save the state $100 million a year. Kamala Harris, who this is not a vote against her. I mean, she's all we got. Let's hope things change. But Kamala Harris, back in one of her campaigns, her organizations or her campaign had actually said that they didn't want to start releasing low-level offenders because they would lose. This was the basis of their argument. They would lose their firefighting task force, right? And that saved the state $100 million a year. So that shows you the importance of who we are and what incarcerated firefighters can provide for the state, right? Which is why, you know, we're on this advocacy in this campaign now to get equality and pay and opportunity once our incarcerated firefighters get out.
Courtney, I'd love for you, thank you so much, Rashid. And Courtney, I'd love for you to also provide your perspective on that question.
Yeah, I completely agree with Rashid. I think that the state absolutely has vested interest, as you said, in exploiting prison labor and most notably of incarcerated firefighters. And as Rashid said, the 13th Amendment stipulates that. And what's fascinating is that, you know, I have spoken to quite a few formerly incarcerated firefighters at this point, and you know, as Rashid mentioned, it's a huge source of pride that people have in serving their communities and saving lives and being on the front lines. And that's all they want when they get out, is to use these skills that they've learned, this vocation they've learned. And, you know, even so, incarcerated firefighters are paid so little. I mean, it really is debt bondage slavery. They get 30 cents per hour in fire camps when they are not actively combating fire, and they get $1 per hour when they are on the front lines combating fire. And that's why the state is saving $100 million a year. But it's still crazy because you have a lot of incarcerated people that want to serve as firefighters because that's the highest paying job. So keep in mind that 30 cents an hour is the highest paying job compared to some people who might be cleaning cells for 11 cents per hour. I mean, that in and of itself speaks to the entire system that exploits prison labor. And so I think that if the state can create the school to prison pipeline, then they sure as hell can create job opportunities and reentry programs for people coming out of prison that actually make sense, that actually serve our communities, that save lives, and help returning citizens return to really important work for them and for society as a whole.
Thank you so much. I'm thinking back to an interview. I've interviewed actually Al Sharpton's biological brother, who is Kenneth Glasgow Sharpton, who talks about this paradigm between being labeled as second-class citizens instead of second-chance citizens. And so I think a lot of people, including myself, have this impression that at least, like, this is totally unreasonable to get such a small amount of pay, but at least you'll get out and you'll have a second chance and you could actually do this. So then all this training and everything kind of evaporates, right? And you start at ground zero again. Is that what I'm understanding?
And yeah, so I...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I often use this story, and I've given it a few times, but I think it draws, like, the best picture and kind of exposes, you know, a little bit of what a bigger chunk of the population is up against, right? So let's say we take a kid, his name is, I don't know, we'll call him Danny. Danny is from the projects in South Central Los Angeles. He's 25 years old. And Danny's never had a job a day in his life. Oh, by the way, he's a high school dropout. And he is a teenage father. So that's his situation. He comes to prison. For the first 3 years, he's just getting into trouble, doing what he's doing. So he's coming to prison at 20 years old. He's just being young. He's impacted by the system. He's doing what he thinks he has to do to survive. Somehow, some way, he gets found eligible. He goes to fire camp. Now, Danny has found a sense of purpose. He's found camaraderie in a way that he's never been a part of. And now he has the opportunity and a skill set to do something that not only is saving his life, both emotionally and physically, but will give him the opportunity to feel like he's saving others' lives or property. He gets out, but now he has to reapply at a junior college to hopefully go get some prerequisites that that he has to have in order to become a firefighter or a wildland firefighter, in hopes that he becomes either a seasonal or a temporary wildland firefighter. And he has to go back to all the harsh conditions in which he came from. But he didn't have time, right, while he was fighting their fires for $1 an hour to learn anything else except firefighting, right? Because he was basically isolated. There were no trades available to him while he was on his downtime. I talked to somebody at Delta Camp. There's no groups available to him there. So there's nothing for him to do other than be a mechanical firefighter out there on the front line, risking it all for $1 an hour. But you know what? He doesn't care. That's where he wants to be. So when he gets out, he's going to have this intention that, you know what? I want to continue doing this. But guess what? He's now in the high risk category of returning back to prison, because that door that he has to go through in order to become a firefighter is so far out ahead of him, mm-hmm. that the chances of him making it, I mean, right now, statistically, 70% of people coming out of incarceration are going back within the first year. Guess where he's at? He's at the top of that 70%, because the only thing he knows is this great skill set that they taught him that, oh yeah, by the way, he can't use immediately upon release. So the chances of him going back to prison are tremendous, which is why the state needs, you want to save money? There's your workforce right there. You're talking about you don't have the manpower because everybody got kicked out. Well, if you would have taken them and put them right into jobs, you wouldn't be having that same argument. So
how does this, in your view, speak to the need to really rethink the system where the criminal record asterisk attached to a name really gets in the way? For me, it seems obvious, but I'm curious from both of your perspectives, how does this really amplify the need to reexamine the weight of this asterisk that gets attached to people's names who have, for one reason or another, been incarcerated? I'd love to hear either of your thoughts.
Yeah, I think all roads lead to abolish. I think that's the only key here is that we have to do away with the system. We have to do away with the system that the state has built to exploit people, that systemically incarcerates Black, Brown, Indigenous bodies. And the system can't be reformed. I think we're so heavily entrenched and indoctrinated in the system that not a lot of reform can be done at this point. We have to really knock it on its head. And move forward and hold the state accountable first and foremost.
And until the system could be abolished, is there any efforts in place that you all know of to begin by removing the stigma or the weight of the criminal record asterisk or the felony asterisk that's attached to formerly incarcerated people's names? So for example, we wouldn't be facing the fire crisis of this magnitude if we didn't have that obstacle.
Yeah, even right now, Assemblywoman, I believe her name is
Rays.
Elise Rays is taking to the Senate floor a bill, AB 2147, that is looking to expunge the records of any incarcerated person that was firefighting. And that would open the doors for them to be able to go out and get these EMT licenses and pursue the career that we love. It still doesn't fix the problem in that we have to have something in place for these people as soon as they come out. And, you know, even going back to Danny, if he was at least making minimum wage working along, you know, the CAL FIRE firefighters doing the same job that they're doing, he would have better opportunity once he got out, because he would have more resources available to him. Because if he was there for 2 years making minimum wage, he'd be able to save a good amount of money that would hopefully, you know, give him the cushion he needs to, you know, either go get some more certifications or to do whatever he needs to do. So, I mean, this type of, you know, bill will help. I mean, it's a great step forward for the incarcerated firefighters. But at the end of the day, there needs to be something more in place that would transition the incarcerated firefighters right out into the workforce. Because why can't, it feels like a slap in the face, right? Why isn't what we're doing now while incarcerated the same thing as the academy for those who are already out there in the workforce? Right. So it's like saying, oh, yeah, we went out and we did all this work for you guys, but now it's negated and no good, and we have to start all over. So, you know, ultimately, you know, abolishing the system is great, but we have to do something now to make these lives really matter.
Repeat the bill for us, please.
It is AB 2147.
Yeah, and I think it'd be really interesting as well to really see who specifically is supporting this bill and who is not supporting this bill. I just had a conversation with somebody earlier who actually noted that the California Professional Firefighters Association, which is a huge union, has really been fighting against the passing of this bill. So I think that's a really big, important key information. And I think as we see, you know, the conversation of defund police take to a national platform, and we talk about, you know, how much of city budgets they control and how much overtime they have and how incredibly powerful these police unions are. I think it's really important to look at those same things within the California Department of Corrections. We don't mention rehabilitation because it really is up to folks to self-rehabilitate inside. But I think, you know, looking at their power, their overtime, their really inflated budgets, and then looking as well at what unions are supporting, what these bills that are so important that we want to pass to give returning citizens opportunity, not just because they deserve it, but because we need them. We need them fighting fires. Climate change, you know, has that these wildfires will be getting worse and worse every year. It really is a life or death situation. And so I think that it's so clear that this bill should pass, and it would be, I think, really interesting to investigate more who the adversaries of this bill really are and why.
Rashid, as somebody who had some training in this area and some experience in this area, do you have any idea why the fight, what is the name of the union, Courtney? The firefighters?
The California Professional Firefighters Association.
Do you have any speculation about why this group would be in opposition to this bill as somebody who was once probably working alongside of those folks?
Well, somebody I was hoping was going to be on this call with us, she had actually quoted I don't know, don't hold me to it, a fire captain or somebody. It was somebody in the firefighting world that was making the argument of, you know, why should they just get to go right in when I've had to work my way in? Well, here's the thing. We're working our way in too, right? Like, we've been to the academy. We've passed our PFTs, our firefighter ones, firefighter twos. We've done all that. We've gotten all the same accolades that you've gotten. Now we just, you know, we want to continue doing this. And so if I had to nail it down to anything, I'd say it's the really old senior firefighters who need to just transition on, because I've worked mutual aid with other fire departments and they are all younger in their 20s and 30s. And, you know, they're living their life and saving lives and property. And not one of them has ever said, man, we wouldn't welcome you to our firehouse, right? So for me, it sounds like some group of old men who's sitting up somewhere, you know, deciding who's God and who's not God.
Group of old men, a group of old white men.
Exactly, old white men.
You know, what it is, yeah.
Who's sitting up there thinking they're gods and making these decisions, you know, but it'd be interesting to see exactly what power they have over this vote. I agree. Right.
Well, and it probably doesn't, they're not taking into account that you just had different entrance points and different obstacles that would have gotten in the way for perhaps of somebody who, in your example of Danny, didn't have just a clear path to the academy to begin with, right? They had to take a different entry path.
Right. And, you know, here's another thing, too, that's shocking and may play a part in that, is that almost every firehouse in the country has thousands of applicants on a list trying to get into those departments. So if you opened up the workforce now to another few thousand individuals to come into these departments, there might be a little bit of a pissing contest, but it's hard for me to see a good majority of firefighters not wanting us alongside them fighting the same battle.
If I could just make a side note, I don't have hard facts on this, but I've just done a really quick Google search. And according to datausa.io, 75.6% of firefighters are white. And so I think that as we really discuss more and more, you know, systemic racism in the US, if you have predominantly white firefighters not welcoming Black and brown people that we have created policies around putting in prison, that is a huge, huge example of systemic racism. Not just who we're putting in prison, but where they're excluded from when they come out.
Thank you for the quick data search. And I'm even curious if, given all the obstacles that they are, that incarcerated firefighters are having to face, I even wonder if they're given, if they're included in the numbers, if they're even counted as such. That would be really interesting to find out. But I agree, this is a really powerful example. Before we go, I'd like to talk a little bit about solutions. And also, I'm going to tell you a couple of misconceptions that I've heard from people that, you know, I challenged, but I'd rather have you have an opportunity to challenge. So first of all, when Governor Newsom talked about this population, this the firefighting population being down because of the COVID pandemic, the language he uses and the language I mistakenly used earlier today is inmate population. And you talked about why it's important to use the word incarcerated as opposed to inmate. Would you like to talk about that for our listeners?
Go ahead, Courtney.
Yeah, so as Rashid pointed out earlier, you know, in 2020, I think really the focus should always be on using people first language. So language that reminds us all that we're all human and that everybody faces different struggles and different obstacles in their life, but we are all human. And so rather than say inmate, which is the language of the state, and saying that we disagree with this system perpetuated by the state, we refuse to use the state's language. And inmate does nothing to humanize someone. People first language stipulates that you recognize they're a person. They are not an inmate, they are an incarcerated person. They're a person that's incarcerated. The same way that we don't say a disabled person anymore, you're a person with a disability. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind. And it's really been a big battle with the press. It's understandable that people use the language of inmate because we're indoctrinated socially with that language. So when our families, our peers, our educators, and our media have always used that language, it's only natural that that's the language we could use. But when we remember that all of these systems are working together, you know, to have us think that these systems exist to protect us, rather than to exploit people for capital gains, that it becomes really important once you realize that to really abandon the language of the state and to say, you know, if I don't believe in this state system, then I can't use state language.
And Rashid, did you want to add on to that at all?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a part of the oppression calling us inmates, right? And the reason why I wanted Courtney to go ahead and speak about it is because this is what we need. We need other people to take on this ideology to help out the incarcerated people, right? Because I could sit here all day long and say, hey, look at me, I'm human, right? But that does nothing. We need other people to be in the same mindset. And so, you know, we will continue to battle this type of oppression And whether it's in words, whether it's in actions, but we'll do something. And it starts with each one of us having that mindset.
Yeah, exactly. Language shapes mindset. So we change language, we could change our mindset.
I can't commit for all press people, but I anchor the Saturday evening news and I report heavily on this topic. So I can commit that me as a reporter, I will do my best. I mean, I am doing my best, but occasionally I slip like earlier. So it is very important. So I'm on your side. I agree.
I'm going to tell you something that is an incarcerated mindset that we always say.
Okay.
Each one teach one. Right? It takes one person to teach the next person to teach the next person. And if you're taking on the lesson, even if you do it one time, even if you slip up and you admonish yourself and catch yourself, that's going to have an impact on so many different people of like, oh, why did that just happen? And there you go. You'll be having an impact and you'll be a part of breaking this system.
Yeah. Small things matter. I hope our listeners can take that away. Absolutely. For sure. I also would like I'm embarrassed to even come forward with this topic and I this comment that I heard, but I think we need to address it. So I heard a woman, actually she was a woman of color, and she was telling me, you know what, I'd love to be a firefighter. And I mentioned, did you know that people who are incarcerated are a major portion of the firefighters? And she had a really ignorant comment and she said, oh, well, I don't know if I'd like to do it then. I would be unsafe. This is problematic for a number of reasons, but what message would you like people like this? What would you like people like this to understand who have this kind of preconceived notion about anybody who's incarcerated and what that would mean, particularly in the firefighting realm, but really in any realm?
Well, it's easy. That's an ignorant point of view. That's not even about firefighting, right? That's something that person needs fixed within them. I once did a mutual aid with the Marin and Greenbrae fire departments where we had a structure fire at San Quentin at one of the houses. And from the time that we got the call, it took us 11 minutes to have that fire out. We were already sitting there taking off our turnouts. And when their fire department showed up, they said, are those incarcerated people? And their fire chief had to actually tell them, yeah, they are. And then proceeded to line them up and give them a lecture about how important response is and taking this job seriously and what the love of this job really looks like, right? And I say that to say that even those firefighters would have never had a clue who we were. I guarantee you that same person, if they were laying on their couch, holding their chest, having a shortness of breath, isn't gonna take the time to say, are you an incarcerated person or a formerly incarcerated person, right? So it's not about us as incarcerated people. It's about that person and whatever they're going through.
And Rashid, I was always just so impressed by, I mean, the number of times you told me that you performed CPR on folks in 2017 alone. How many times was that?
There were 20, almost like 23 to 28 people that passed inside of San Quentin. I did CPR on almost every one of them. But in the little over 2 years that I was there, I've done CPR almost 50 times, and most medical professionals won't even do CPR twice in their whole career.
That's impressive. So we've been talking about a really heavy problem and the need to create change. In previous weeks, I've been talking heavily just about the COVID pandemic and how it really amplified the need to release people and rethink so many things. And now we have this other more complicated issue. I mean, something that just layers on the complication of we have fires across the state, unbreathable air. We're all on house arrest in some ways. What are the action items, or what is kind of the hope that's at the end of this? What can people be doing to raise awareness, to take action, to try to fight for change around this?
So I think one, we really need to be demanding mass releases and mass evacuations. It's really important to note that in the city of Vacaville, which is under forced evacuation, meaning that everybody has been forced to leave the town because of encroaching fires, the only people left are incarcerated people. So CMF which stands for California Medical Facility, which is already a prison full of medically vulnerable people. So you can have anyone treating cancer, you can have paraplegics, anybody that's medically vulnerable inside. You have Solano, 5 minutes away, where the animal shelter right next to the prison has been evacuated. And the state has no evacuation plans for prisons in disaster areas. And so that's not just now, that's before. And so I think that's really important to highlight, that we really should be demanding mass releases, one, to prevent the spread of COVID, where incarcerated people are 700% more likely to get COVID because of inhumane infrastructures within prisons and because of complete overcapacity, but also because what is the state going to do? Are they going to let them burn and die? I mean, the state has no answers and they're not proposing anything. And I think it's really important that we come together and demand that they evacuate these prisons and come up with a plan, because again, we will be experiencing this year on year on year. And secondly to that, to really support the passing of AB 2147 that Rashid mentioned, which would allow folks with a felony to be able to qualify for EMT certification that they have studied and worked so hard to be able to qualify for.
And how can people put pressure for the release of prisoners? We know about the actions that have taken place around San Quentin for the release of medically vulnerable or what are deemed to be low risk incarcerated people. How do we also apply pressure? Or how can people apply pressure to releasing people from places like Vacaville, where lives could be at danger? Who should they be calling?
Great question. You can find our social media, Facebook and Instagram, No Justice Under Capitalism. No Justice Under Capitalism. We really are focused on throwing agitational protests, and we plan on doing so this Sunday in front of Ralph Diaz's, in demanding mass releases and mass evacuations to save lives.
And you can follow organizations and contact organizations like Restore Justice or Initiate Justice, who are launching campaigns to get things on ballots and to have, you know, certain laws and stuff changed, who are doing great work.
Thank you both for taking the time. We're down to just a couple of seconds left. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this important topic, and let's stay in touch and talk soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bye.
All right.